The following content is provided under a Creative Commons license. Your support will help MIT OpenCourseWare continue to offer high-quality educational resources for free. To make a donation or view additional materials from hundreds of MIT courses, visit MIT OpenCourseWare at ocw.mit.edu.
Again, some of this might be familiar to folks who have taken CMS 611, but it's I've sort of revised this so that I can give you more board game examples. And I just want to go a little bit on the kind of aesthetic thing that we're talking about in assignment 2. We'll go more into things about the user experience over the next couple of weeks. But so far, we've been talking about this kind of aesthetic. It came up in the MDA paper where we've been talking about mechanics, we've been talking about strategies that come out from the dynamics of a game coming up, the way how your rules play out, to be able to give you a sense that some games are about subterfuge and some games are about pressing your luck. There are some there are some games about just dealing with random things that happen to you, and some games about sort of dethroning the king, right? These are what a lot of your games have been about. Some games have been about feeling smart, you know? It's like when you make set, it's like, oh, I feel really, really smart about that. And those come out from the design, from your rules. That's what assignment 1 was all about. You've done a great job with that. But of course, that's not the only thing that's involved in the aesthetic of a game. We're talking about these things as well. I already talked a little bit about game bits with the Donald Norman discussion, but also things like the tone of the writing in your rules. In this particular in assignment 1, it was fairly straightforward, but you could imagine writing everything in ye old English, or I think Space Alert has is a game where the rules are written as if it was a cadet manual. Only a cadet manual that's setting you up for a mission that is doomed to failure. Space Alert is actually a really good example of sound as well, and I'll play some tracks from it. It's a game that has an accompanying CD. But what other games have really distinctive sounds, like board games, card games, casino games? Like what are the sort of things that you
Operation.
Remember?
Operation.
Yeah.
Sorry?
Oh, because you say sorry? Wait,
well, no,
wait,
I think the whole thing.
Yeah.
No, that's true.
Yeah, see?
No, the sorry card revenge, where you also press.
It's different between sorry and trouble.
Sorry and trouble.
Sorry card game rules, though.
You probably read it.
Otherwise, it's the exact same
game.
Yahtzee.
Taboo.
Taboo has a buzzer. But also a lot of it's
a
dialogue game, so there's also the accompanying sound around, you know, that's coming out of everybody's mouths.
Gestures.
Oh, I haven't played that one.
It's like charades, only that you have a timer, and like the timer has like a really loud tick to it.
So. Oh, so it ticks down so you can hear it running out of time.
Jeopardy.
That's yeah. Okay. All right. Yeah.
Poker. Everyone's shuffling.
Oh yeah, that's just the little tinkle of the chips. Slot machines, of course. Yeah, you know, a whole bank of slot machines. You very rarely hear a single slot machine operating by itself. Electronic slot machines obviously have a slightly different tone to it than mechanical slot machines. Roulette, I find, is very very distinctive sound. Just that little ball bouncing over the bumps. So definitely think a little bit about that, you know, about the sound of your game, especially if you're making a game that's about conversation or about over the table exchange. Taboo is a game that is punctuated with like ums and ah, you know, whereas something like charades, the sound of that is a lot of shouting usually, right? You know, it's like everyone just like saying random things. The first thing that comes to their mind is it's almost a free association game, and of course. The look of your game. I mean, that should be taken for granted. But, and we've got a couple of examples of various boxes that you can take a look at. And of course, that's what people normally associate with storytelling in games, but could also be thought of as world building in games. What's the theme of your game? What's the plot and the characters of your game? Are you making the, you know, instead of the Trivial Pursuit game, the Twilight Trivial Pursuit game or something like that, and you've got the setting, you've got characters, even though the game mechanics are all the same. But the games that integrate that better with the game mechanics and rules and the art direction, the games that do a poorer job. We've got some examples of that. So let me talk about a few of these games. How many of you played Forbidden Island? How many of you played Pandemic? Okay, so Forbidden Island is kind of is by the same designer and it still has that a lot of the same cooperative feel. And if you, you know, first of all, you have this metal tin that sort of makes you think that this game is worth more and you should be paying more for it. But, you know, you've got this like nice little art that sort of, and because you have to open up this metal tin, makes you think a little bit about, you know, opening up a treasure chest. Inside, you've actually got these nice little treasure pieces, a goblet, this kind of like translucent crystal. Yeah, they're all plastic, they're, you know, kind of rubberized plastic so that they'll last a little bit longer, but you know, you can sort of see that this has got Cheru Lion, I don't know, Griffin or something. You know, it's got some of like old world here, some sort of mystic civilization. And when you look at the cards, you know, you've got the choice of the fonts, you've got these kinds of like very serifed and a little bit like broken up text that looks like it might be old kind of letterpress, and of course all of the art that's on every single card. The game mechanics of this game are about various parts of an island turning into water, and they don't actually have different illustrations when they get flooded. They just have the same picture, only bluish. So it's just sort of, you know, it's cheap to print this, right? Because it's monochromatic. I guess it's not really monochromatic because they have a color token at the bottom. But it sort of gives you the idea that when you play this game, everything kind of looks nice and colorful, and then as the game goes on, things start turning bluer and bluer. So it gives you the sense that there's more and more water surrounding this island as it keeps flooding. And you know, all these pieces, which represents each one is a different player's token, could, you know, doesn't necessarily need to be shaped human, but it kind of like makes you think that there is a human head and there's a piece. It's all this adds cost to the production of this. Of course, the metal tin also add a cost to the production of a game like this. But it goes a long way to making you feel like I'm not just moving pieces on a board; I'm actually exploring an island and robbing it of its treasures. But it's, you know, but it's trying to get us. This is actually a counter of kind of like the flood levels, and they got game mechanic stuff. It says novice, normal, elite, and legendary, so it sort of sets you up with a difficulty level when the game starts. But you know, you have a water level that goes from bottom to top, as opposed to top to bottom. You can imagine this counter working just as well going downwards or upwards, but since it's about flooding, it goes from bottom and then the water level rises and rises and rises. And of course on top they have a skull, right? You know, it's like, you know, it's not just that the game ends. It's the game ends and everyone dies. Let's just be clear about that. So it does a nice job of getting that across. It's actually a cooperative game, and does a pretty good job of sort of taking all of these ideas, the setting of the waterlogged island, the art direction of what happens to the pieces as you flip them over, and then of course the rules that determine when the water level rises and how much space you've got to navigate and how you deal with those problems. I like to describe all of the stuff that we've been talking so far as systemic aesthetics. So these are the aesthetics that the system is creating. All the things that have to do with art style, writing tone, the sound, the pieces that you're holding, more as stylistic aesthetics. And then there's the fiction. The fiction will be the story, will be the characters, will be the setting of the game. But of course, this is kind of a blurry Venn diagram, because there's a lot of things that come in between. So for instance, the way how your board looks is obviously a combination of the mechanics that specify the information that you need to be able to put on the board, but also the style of how you display that information and how that sort of reinforces the setting that you want your players to be in. The kind of feedback that you give people, like the taboo buzz, for instance, you know, the sound of that buzz is in here, but obviously the rules are set up so that it's you know, the moment you hear that buzz, it's kind of like as jarring and nerve-wracking as possible, right? Because they're trying to concentrate on not saying the right, the wrong thing, and then when the moment you slip up, another player will buzz it, and then you know you get the shock of your life. And that's all intentional. For art direction and for style and fiction, those tend to be things that that people have less trouble thinking about. You know, how realistic do you want your setting to be? This is a game called King of Tokyo, which is really mechanically it's everyone gang up on the leader, and this you know this is a game where you're trying to be a monster taking over Tokyo, and there's a lot of other monsters who want your spot. And once you are on top of that mountain, everyone's trying to take you down. That's what this game is about. But you can see it's kind of got this goofy, not quite anime style, you know, but still evocative of old Japanese movies. We've got a little picture of Tokyo Bay on fire here. You can't actually see the monsters in here. You just see a lot of like helicopters and everything, just to sort of see the collateral damage that you're going. But I believe it's mostly a dice rolling game.
It's Yahtzee.
So the mechanics are all about, you know, you roll the dice and you try to roll well. So they put in a lot of effort to try to paint that mechanic in stylistic and in fictional elements to make it a little bit more engaging and frankly a lot more saleable. This is Richard Garfield, who is also the designer of Magic the Gathering, the original designer of Magic the Gathering. So it's got a good pedigree. In between the systemic and the fictional elements, you can do things like events. Twilight Struggle, another excellent game, is about the Cold War, basically. And you've got cards in here that remind people of real things that actually happened. They don't necessarily happen in the order that they happened in real life. There are things like the space race. There's things like various presidents and various world various Soviet and U.S. leaders from the Cold War. This one specifically says 1945 to 1989. And so while you're playing this game, yeah, there are mechanical results for all of those cards that you're flipping over, but because they also have pictures and names of the actual events that hopefully, this is largely targeted at people who have lived through this era, or at least remember things that harken from that era, and is trying to be evocative of that. Whereas, you know, it's a fairly mechanical, it's not quite a war game, it's more like a politics game. Balance of power game. But they use events to sort of remind you of what the setting of this game is. You know, I call it fiction, but of course this is not fiction. This is based on what actually happened. But it's still a setting, right? Roles and abilities. Back to Forbidden Island. Every single character that you play in Forbidden Island has a different set of abilities that you've got. You're taking on a different role, like an explorer or a diver. I can't remember what all the roles are. There's no indication on the box on what you can be. But since everybody has different abilities, that sort of harkens back to, you know, what are the unique defining things of the character that you're playing, and you try to think in that role. If you're a pilot or something like that, you try to think about rescuing people. If you're a diver, you're sort of trying to like forge ahead and going and you can stay close to the water mechanically, but also, you know, puts you in a fictional position in your team to be able to be closer to risk, because, you know, other people will just drown if they're too close to water. I think that's how that's how the game works, if I recall. So for assignment 2, we want you to be thinking about all of these things. Obviously, it's difficult to do this on the amount of time and the budget that you're working with, but we want you to consider how your game looks, how your game sounds, what is the setting that your game is in. We've already had a couple of things like the Spice game, for instance, you know, could just have been an information, a game about sort of hidden variables, but then you kind of have this layer of being a agent of an unknown country, and sometimes the fiction can actually help people better understand the underlying rules that you've got. I know that this game, the game started off as a building construction game, right? So, and to a certain extent, some version of those rules might actually help people understand your rules easier. But then, of course, sometimes it gets in the way because your fiction may not necessarily match up with the way that your rules are evolving. And this part, I'm not saying that you should let aesthetics necessarily constrain what you can do with rules. But if you're going to change your rules and you're going to have to iterate on your rules to make your game playable and do everything that you've done with assignment one, you want to make sure that your aesthetic is coherent with that, so that you don't have things in your storyline or your character design or your art style that are outright contradicting what your rules are trying to tell you. Like, this is a game about friendly cooperation, and then you're saying all of you are on this island together and trying to save yourselves, but really the way how your rules work out is every man for themselves. That would be a contradiction. This is an interesting game. Who's played Ticket to Ride? Okay. Box design and title can play a very, very large part in setting that expectation. So it wasn't so something I stressed so much in the first assignment, what you titled your game. But in the second assignment, the title of your game can sometimes be the first clue of what your game's all about. It's a rail building game. You can see from the back a picture of the board, and you're sort of building these tracks. But if you actually read the box, it says October 2nd, 1900, 28 years to the day that noted London eccentric Phileas Fogg accepted and won a $20,000 bet that he could travel around the world in 80 days. Now, at the dawn of the century, it is time for a new impossible journey. Travel across the United States, the impossible journey. now at the dawn of so some old friends have gathered to celebrate Fogg's impetuous and lucrative gamble and to propose a new wager of their own. The stakes $1 million in a winner takes all competition. The objective, to see which of them can travel by rail to the most cities in North America in just 7 days. It's interesting because at first glance, you look at the game mechanics, and the game mechanics actually feel more like you're sort of building railway connections rather than riding the rails. But if you look a little bit closer at the strategies of this game, what this game really comes down to is blocking other people from completing their routes around America, which actually gets closer to, I think, the theme that they're suggesting, right? It's not about who can complete. It's not about, is it possible for you to complete a route around America in 7 days? No, it's who can do it fastest, which means how do I slow down everybody else? And that's actually what high-level strategy in this game turns out to be. So it's about all these tickets that you're picking up, and you're going from place to place, you're trying to complete routes, and you're trying to prevent other people from completing their routes. One of the interesting things about this game is that you've got all these people that are on the box. And of course, the assumption is that you are one of these people, and that's deliberate. The board game designers wanted to slap someone on this box that you could personally identify with, and says, "I want to be this, this person who looks like Passepartout, or this person who looks like Phineas Fogg because I like those books." But then when you actually play the game, there is no real embodiment of any of these characters. There's no like piece that you place down that says, "I am this person." And the only sort of level of fiction that's sort of represented in the rules are the tickets and the routes that you're taking, not the people. So they've gone to this very large effort to make you think that this is to make you think that this is a game about people. I guess because they thought that games about people tend to sell better than games about trains, but the game's really about trains. So I guess it's like a giant train. Let's see. Can I talk about these other games?
So Alien Frontiers, anybody know the term worker placement? Like worker placement game where you have a limited number of resources that you're just basically applying to different sections on the board, which give you points or do things for you. So it's a great game about colonizing this world. So a lot of really good like old style 50s and 60s style like science fiction art, lots of rockets, spaceships, things like that, and your actual bits. And the reason I'm using this one is because this is a game that starts off with kind of like a plasticky Euro style, so cubes and things like that represent, like they don't really represent anything. Your bits, your ships, are these dice. You buy a rocket, you roll the rocket, it gives you a number, and then using those numbers you can apply it to various different places on the board. So state saving is actually pretty good because you can put the piece down, it stays there. If it gets moved around, it doesn't really matter if it changes number, because you use the number just when you're placing down the piece. The number is no longer relevant anymore. One thing we see in a lot of student games, people using dice as counters. A little bit easier with die 6 because it's squared, but once you start using like the D20s as a counter, they've got really small facets and they're gonna roll and you're gonna lose your place. Also, the amount of time it takes to go from one number to the other number really increases the time it takes to play the game. But one thing they've done, it started off with these little chips, now they've added more plastic bits, special powers that you can get to move around that look zany. Little alien pieces of technology, and colonies that you can place that kind of look like colonies now. I don't have it here, it's not released yet, but it's on order. They actually made the rocket dice, so dice in the shape of rockets. So imagine this as an oblong shape that's kind of curved with cut faces on it. One thing I'm curious is how is that going to roll? How is it going to, like, they've made it so that it feels more representational, like, it feels more like part of the theme, but it might actually take away from the actual feel of rolling dice. So I'll be interested in seeing how that plays out when I play that, when it comes out.
And the act of rolling dice, of course, has its own distinctive sound, right? That's shared among any group. People have positive associations with that sound.
And then the other one. Game about trucking, the Great Heartland Hauling Company. So on the box, you see semi-truck carrying little squares. On the back, you see semi-trucks and squares, but the squares are on and a map. But the squares don't really fit on the trucks. So actually, I brought this out thinking that's a great way of saying it's not kind of like the other one. They're showing something on the box that doesn't actually exist in the game, but I found out when I actually took it out and opened it. They have cards where you put your bits on. So you are kind of carrying things around, but there's a disconnect between the map, where things are on the map, and where things are on your truck, and then where your truck is actually placed on the map. So your eyes are kind of going to different places when you're actually playing out the game. Largely done because of the commercial manufacturing constraints of it. As you can see, it's basically just two decks in a small box. You see a lot of these games, they want, if it's a game that they want you to play in a short period of time, it's likely going to have a smaller box than a game that's going to play longer. It's kind of a code for how complicated the game is or how much of your time the game's going to take.
Definitely pay attention to how your pieces feel. Again, we're not asking you to go, you know, completely to town with like laser cutting pieces or anything like that. That's not necessary. Just that every time you like think of a piece in our box, or if you decide to glue two pieces together, for instance, to be able to make it a different shape or something, think about what that's communicating over to the player. Think about what the box, or what the art in your rules is conveying about how the game is supposed to be played, and try not to mislead your players into thinking, you know, that this game is really about stacking things on little plastic trucks when it really isn't. It's about putting stacking things on cards, that sort of thing. So, yeah. Any questions about assignment 2?
And note on the assignment, it's not asking for polished art.
Yeah.
So think about materials, think about the textures. It's still a short assignment, so don't think about that kind of art.
But yeah.
More about the which pieces you decide to use. And really think about the title is really, really important.
Yeah. The title is something, writing, is something that you can spend, you can get a lot out of a little bit more time investment. The tone of your writing and your rules can go a long way. But still looking for rules that are easy to read. So, don't use like Shakespearean spelling or something like that. That might make things a little bit trickier. Unless you're very, very consistent with it throughout and you're only using it for nouns or something, which could work pretty well. Sketchy art is fine. Just like this, a hint of what you are trying to get across with your art. We're not judging anybody on your ability to draw, but we are interested in your thought process in how you consider how you represent your game. All right.
So the first line is like the assignment says design a board card game that focuses on given player experience. Mm-hmm. Do we get to choose the experience we want to?
Yeah. That and that comes down back to the overall aesthetic, right? All of these things are working together to sort of generate a player experience. And we'll be going through some examples of other games that generate the user experience of panic, experience of close shave cooperation, right? Remember Mechanics Dynamics aesthetics. The aesthetic thing is the player that actually experiences, and that's true for all for any definition of aesthetic. The question is, what are all the things that you can do to hopefully generate that? Now, of course, you only know whether you're hitting that with playtesting.
Is it supposed to be a quick game, like the first one? Or
Do we have time limit in the...
I think I just copied it over, so yeah,
20 minutes.
20 minutes, yeah, 20 okay.
Minutes.
So aim for that. I think it's a little longer than the last one,
yeah.
But yeah. So yeah, and the reason for that is largely we want to be able to grade these things and get your grades back to you. So if you made a 2-hour long game and everybody makes a 2-hour long game, we're never gonna finish grading this thing. So short games help, and short games are easy to test.
And for the first question, on Monday we'll be talking about how to choose an experience. One method for choosing experiences. We'll do that right before we get into brainstorming and team forming.
Cool. All right. I guess we're ending a little early today, man.
Yeah.
Alright, thanks everyone. Don't forget to sign in if you haven't already. Actually, just about everybody did.
Okay.
Yep, thank you. Oh, yeah, please sign in your work.